Welcome to the Game Developer Podcast. On this special Games of the Year edition, the editors here at GameDeveloper.com got together and talked about our favorite games of 2023 into tasty chats we've put together into one episode. This episode, as usual, is produced by Jordan Mallory. You can find all of our pieces and all of our work on GameDeveloper.com. Welcome to the Game Developer Podcast. Today we have a very special episode, all centered on a few of the Game Developer staff's favorite games of the year. I'm Danielle Riendo, the EIC here at Game Developer, and I'm joined by two esteemed colleagues, Community Editorial Coordinator Holly Green and Staff Editor Justin Carter. Welcome, my dear friends. Would you like to say hello?
Good afternoon.
Hey.
It is a good afternoon, isn't it? Because we're going to talk about Baldur's Gate 3, a game that is absolutely on my 2025 Game of the Year list when I finally get to play it. But I wanted to talk to both of y'all because it's on both of your lists. And that's kind of how this format's going to work. We're going to kind of talk about places where we had overlap on our lists on some of the games that we liked the most this year. And these are all just personal opinions. There is no, one true game or anything like that. It's just, here's the things that we really liked. We're going to have fun with this. I want to hear a little bit about Baldur's Gate 3 and why it caught your eye, caught your gaming attention, I suppose. How did Baldur's Gate 3 wind up on your lists? That's what I would love to know.
Holly, did you do this early access or did you just do it straight from when it launched in 1.0?
Yeah, I did do early access, and to be honest, I kind of gave up on it really early when it was in early access. It was not in good shape, and it was just, for various reasons, I just wasn't ready to commit to the story. And maybe because in the back of my head, I knew it wasn't the complete experience, and obviously it was unpolished. I'd actually played Baldur's, the original games, way back in the 90s. So seeing the game come back in a big way was surprising. Honestly, I didn't ever think I'd see Baldur's Gate 3 at all. I certainly didn't expect it to be so much better than the original games. It's just really, in a world where games these days really, at least the mainstream stuff that you play, really isn't allowed to express much of a personality or an opinion or a sense of humor, something like Baldur's Gate 3 is very refreshing, in my opinion. And I think that's partially what's captivated so many other people too. Just you can't really get much better than their particular dialogue and the variety of it, and just doesn't wear out its welcome in that sense. But
I think for me, there were two things about Baldur's Gate 3 that caught my attention forever ago. One of them was the fact that you just have a tadpole in your brain, which is a wild-ass setup for any video game.
I did not know this.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing.
The game opens with you getting a sentient tadpole in your brain, and you've got to try to get it out. And then awesome. Also, it was it's a full-on, straight-up Dungeons & Dragons game. I feel like most people, Dungeons & Dragons doesn't really get a lot of video games, or at least not a lot of ones that get people's attention. So and this was also coming right around the time of stuff like Critical Role, Dimension 20, and other actual play shows were having a real big come up during the pandemic and all that. So this hit it very much just the right time. And also there aren't a lot of RPGs with rules anymore. There are just RPGs that are action games or shooters. But this is full on turn based. You need to build your stats. You need to manage your inventory and things like that. But I think really caught a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah, the problem with trying to do a Dungeons & Dragons game is the complexity, right? You're never going to be able to really have that free, open experience that you might have under a human dungeon master in real time. But they still managed to do a fairly good job. And I know some people say, if you don't actually play Dungeons & Dragons, then it's going to be really hard to get into or pick up on Baldur's Gate 3. But I don't know that I agree, honestly, because I don't play the tabletop game. And I love Baldur's Gate. It took some trial and error to really understand things like spells. But honestly, I I don't mind that at all, that it's been a slow learning process.
I think the game sort of like understands that it's working with a limited system in 5e, and also that a lot of people probably just haven't, they've experienced D&D, but they haven't actually played D&D, like if not ever, then at least within like the last decade or so, which I think is the perfect reason why save scumming exists, because otherwise the game just completely falls apart because it is so rigid. And sometimes it'll just completely screw you over, like with a dice roll or with something going horribly wrong. So if you couldn't save scum and just reload a save instantly, I think the game would lose a lot of its appeal, except for like, the hardcore crowd.
Yeah. In that sense, save scumming almost kind of plays that role of the DM who's changing things in real time in order to kind of keep the game together, you know?
Right.
Oh, I like that. I also have heard that it has almost immersive elements. I'm the MSim dork. I'm sure you both know this because you have to spend time with me. But I'm a giant immersive sim dork. And that is one of the main things, as someone who you know, has never played D&D before, it was one of the main things that made me like, oh God, I got to play this. That, and you know, the obvious things like the, I'll just say romantic encounters that I've heard about in this game.
Horniest game ever made.
It's a very horny game.
Yeah, it sounded fun. Like,
and like I'm that person that I'm just kind of like, eh, like that's not, so to me, everyone's out of their minds in this game. I'm like, I don't understand. Like, I don't deserve this attention, first of all.
Everyone in this game is either like batshit nuts or extremely horny, sometimes both.
Sometimes
it's
both.
Honestly like very funny.
And like they spend the whole game telling you how great you are too, and I'm sitting here like, I don't know about all that. Like,
you don't need to whine and dine me, dude. Like, you can just be yourself.
Like, I have healthy self-esteem, but this is a bit much. Like, maybe you need to.
It's got the BioWare problem where, like, within 2 minutes, everyone's already in love with you. It's just like, all right, can you take it down several notches? If not for your respect, then mine.
It's like some kind of Tenchi Muyo style harem anime, or just like I don't understand.
Like, leave me alone, Kale. Like, I'm not interested. We can just be friends.
I mean, it makes sense. It's just, it seems like there's so much stuff here in general. And I know, and I'm sure this is, by the way, spoiler alert, this is a two-part discussion. We broke the team into two. We have six folks here. We have three of us on this one and three of us in a future episode that I suspect they'll also perhaps touch on this game, if not Hitman. You know, I'm just that's a future joke.
I think we all know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Like, let me tell you about our Lord and Savior, Agent 47, for the next half hour.
Exactly. That probably won't end up happening, but you know, hey, some of us, it's an MSim.
We've all got our game.
We've all got our game, and it's very good. But it does seem like there's just so much here, and people have customized their experiences. And actually, our colleague Bryant Francis did a great blog about the quest design in this game and just how nuanced it can be and how cool it is. It just seems like there's a lot of good game here and thoughtful game here and good writing and good characters. And it's going to be my 2025 game of the year, probably. That's what I keep joking. And I'm honestly being a little like, 2025 might be too optimistic for when I'll have time to play this. It might be like, I'm retired and I have a little time and I play it. But, you know, we'll
just in a shack, got a little fishing hole, rocking back and forth my chair, be like, it's time to play it now.
Really, that's got my life.
You gotta get a Steam Deck. You gotta get a Steam Deck and take that on the road. Like, well,
I'm thinking about getting the PlayStation 5 version just so I can finally like. I haven't played it in so long, so I think I'm gonna bite the bullet and get the PS5 version.
That makes
sense. Just so my laptop doesn't burst into flames.
that's a real listen. You're dealing with magic here. That's a real. It's a real thing that could happen. I want to talk about some more magic. We're moving right along. We've got a lot of games to look at least from y'all. I have a couple. But I want to talk more about some RPG magic. Justin, you had Sea of Stars on your list, and I sure hope it's an RPG, because otherwise that really wouldn't have been a great segue. So
it's actually a cooking minigame. I'm sorry to tell you this.
No.
No.
it's really about making soup.
One of your guys is a cook, actually, and he does teach you like how to make stuff, but it's all very basic.
Excellent.
he rules. Yeah. No, Sea of Stars is like a throwback to the old, like, I guess like 80s and 90s RPGs. It's just very charming. I played the demo like months ago and it just sort of sold me right away. I had a friend who was more into that stuff when I was growing up, but sort of over time as I've grown up and played more RPGs, this just really interested me. And it's kind of Paper Mario, not Paper Mario, but the Mario RPG-ish.
Oh, yeah. Where, yes.
You can block or attack based on timing. There's one power, which is basically just a straight up lift from the old Mario RPGs. You can like kick a shell back and forth. It's incredibly overpowered. I use it to cheese just about every boss encounter in the game, but it also rules. You can also hit enemies with basic attacks and then absorb these magic orbs to sort of build on your other powers and do team attacks. It's just a very good and rewarding combat system. And the environments that you go to are, it's a very charming game and sort of just one of those where you play it and you sort of know whether or not you're going to be into it within like 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I love the way it looks. I like RPGs for sure. I've never like disliked RPGs, but for me as a, you know, pixel art enthusiast, I have like gushed over screens of this game and been like, I can't wait to play this in 2025 as well. You know, it's on my list for that as well.
Yeah. It's got a very good art direction, especially in like some of that back half stuff, which I'm not going to spoil, but there's some very cool stuff towards the end, including the true ending that I've seen float around.
Justin, thank you for that voyage on the Sea of Stars. Appreciate that. I'm gonna do one here where I say, we're going from the Sea of Stars to the sea, to the beautiful seas. Well, some of them are beautiful. I want to talk about Dave the Diver, and then we're going to talk about Dredge, which is on my list and Holly's list. But Holly, would you like to tell us a little bit about this Dave the Diver and his sushi adventures?
Yeah. Wait, Justin, did you play Dave the Diver?
I did not, know. I haven't played Dredge either. This is all you two.
Oh, bummer.
I've heard they're really great. I just sad. Kind of missed them.
There's just like a lot of fish going on this year.
Yeah, a lot of fish.
Fish are so hot right now. you know, I think the first thing I heard about Dave the Diver was that so there's just a lot going on. It's kind of, at times it almost feels like five games in one kind of situation where, you know, you're playing this diver and you're diving in the water to catch fish and you've got assorted like special research and science projects kind of associated with that, documenting these fish and collecting specimens and, you know, your typical side quest stuff. But, you know, you're doing that by day and then at night you're taking these fish and serving sushi in your restaurant. And so it kind of goes from being like, you know, you got your fishing sim going on with light combat stuff occasionally. And then up above the ocean level, you're, you know, serving customers and making the sushi and stocking things and managing employees. And then additionally on top of that, also trying to build the restaurant's popularity and manage their social media presence and that sort of thing. Yeah. So the game, like, I really like this game. It will probably exhaust you really fast. Like, they do a fairly good job of, maintaining enough structure and giving you enough stuff to go on that you kind of, you know what your goals are and what you're supposed to be doing. But there's so much that happens in one single day that it's like real life where you're just like, okay, this is the end of my day. I really just want to stare at the floor, fellas. you know, like, yeah. That's, yeah, not necessarily what you get to do. But it is a charming game. I love the pixel artwork. I mean, it's not like the most, you know, advanced or breathtaking pixel art I've seen in my life, but it's just got that nice, you know, the tropical palette to it. It's just very, it just that, you know, bright and vibrant, but like mellowed just a bit. Like, I really like that. They've nailed, I can't remember if it's supposed to take place in like Hawaii, but it's a tropical setting, you know, that's a very relaxing part of it. Getting to see tropical fish that are very much real and, you know, in real life. And okay, so you're killing them and catching them. But the point is that you're also documenting them. It's just all around a great game. You know, if there's one little thing about you don't like, you're probably going to find something else because there's just so much to do. You may also become like me, you know, have to do it one day at a time and take it in these little bite-sized bits, because it can really vary quite a bit between this relaxing experience where you're catching fish and then the high energy of serving sushi. It's in that sense, you might confuse your own body a little bit in terms of your adrenaline and energy levels, to be like, wow, are you like jogging? What are you doing? These adrenaline rushes are confusing.
I'm a little worried about Dave, and that does he get enough sleep? Like, does Dave get enough sleep? You know, like,
you know, and the thing about Dave too, like Dave, I don't know if you've seen the character Dave. He's a big guy. Like, he's a really, really fit scuba diver because he's doing all this stuff, like literally killing sharks and stuff as needed. and then you get to the surface and, like, I swear that scuba diving been like wearing him out all day, because then he has to like jog up and down the bar to serve sake and beer and stuff. And he's huffing and puffing the whole time. And I'm like, come on. I seen you just lugging 60 pounds of weight underneath the water at 400 feet deep. I know you can, you know, pick it up a little bit, but nah, he's had a long day. We're going to give Dave some slack.
Yeah, Dave.
He is tired. Dave is very tired. We're going to cut him some slack. He's in very great shape. I got to give him some credit.
Yeah.
I
love it, honestly. Yeah. Well, from the bright seas to the least bright seas, I suppose, from Dave the Diver to Dredge. Dredge is on it's really quite close to the top of my list, personally. It's one of my favorite games of the year by far. And I suppose there's a little bit of connective tissue here with Dave the Diver, other than just the sort of seed theme, which is just how kind of tight the core gameplay loops are. You are fishing, you know, it's obviously there's that part that's there together. You're fishing. You're also kind of navigating terrifying waters. And you're also doing some trading and sort of inventory management, and also kind of engaging with this story that I think is really, really, really cool. Spooky as hell. I love the art style. There's just a lot going on here as well that I suppose makes me think a little bit of like, Dave's kind of doing a little bit of this stuff too. And also, I got to say, I think your captain is also very tired. But Holly, I want to hear your thoughts on Dredge as well, because it's also on your list. It's also one of your favorites this year.
It is. Honestly, we made the agreement this year with the Game of the Year list not to put numbers on anything or actually rank it. But I think secretly Dredge is like probably the Game of the Year for a game developer, just in terms of how much coverage we did, how much everyone loved it. You know, I love that the developers set out to make kind of a spookier, creepier version of the fishing game in Stardew Valley, because I actually really loved the fishing mini game in Stardew Valley. However, I strongly believe it was a direct contributing factor to the development of Carpal Tunnel in my wrist. It was not necessarily well designed, and especially for PC, right?
Yeah.
But if you love collecting specimens, which as a Pokemon fan I very much do, then Dredge is wonderful. Like, there's a lot going on with it. Like, it's got a pretty good story. I like the navigation aspects, sure. But for me, it's about collecting specimens. What can I say? and they did manage to take the actual, you know, game part of it, the mini game part of it, and make it a little bit more interesting than what Stardew Valley does, and a little less taxing on the wrist. So I appreciated that as well. You got a lot out of it too, didn't you? I mean, that's one of the few games this year that you got to really, really lean into.
Yeah, there's only five on my list. I joke about this. God, ever since I've like been an editor-in-chief, I guess, maybe, which is my last job and this job, where it's just like the number of games on my Games of the Year list has like just plummeted every year. It used to be very hard to pick 10. And now I'm like, I'm going to get 5 if it kills me. Not, it won't. It's not actually that serious. But, you know, I got to 5 and was very excited, because it's tough out there. It's tough to play new games. There's a lot of Into the Breach to play. I don't understand. There's jobs to do and Into the Breach to play. This is me joking at myself. But Dredge is fantastic. It kind of hit all the buttons for me. Also, I'm a horror fan, so I loved how just spooky and creepy it is. I love the sort of, it almost has a little bit of a, not exactly sanity meter, but it's something along those lines. There's sort of like creepiness that kind of comes in and gives you like a cold, wet hug, you know, it's a little bit of one of those, which I super enjoy. It's also cool to celebrate, you know, this is a studio, this is their first game. It's four people, largely. I'm not sure if they had contractors doing anything else, but you know, there's something nice about that as well to kind of celebrate. Like you made something real awesome on your first go as a team. And that just feels good. And of course, we had a lot of fun chats with them. If you want to check out Game Developers coverage of the game, we did. We actually did a podcast with them on this very show, on this very feed that you can listen to. We talked a lot about physics and about art design and about creature design. And Chris Kerr, our news editor, has interviewed those folks a couple times this year, I think, actually. One of my favorite stories from those interviews is a bug where the waves, you used to be able to like ride the waves to essentially like fly across half the map, which is very funny to me. Game development. It's a blast. It's almost like super powered, which brings us right into Justin. I've got two more of your games here. Hey, super powered. Tell me a little bit about this Marvel's Spider-Man 2 and TMNT Splintered Fate. You can go whatever order you like. This is your time to shine. Tell me about these games.
All right. So Ninja Turtles Splintered Fate is literally just Hades, but with Ninja Turtles.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is, yeah, no, literally. Yeah. So the setup, like it's straight up a roguelike just with the Ninja Turtles in it. You know the deal, like do a run, die, repeat. You can switch between like any of the four turtles at a home base, and they've all got their own talents. It's right now it's currently an Apple Arcade exclusive, and I just picked it up. I tried it out just because I had like a free trial, whatever. And I've honestly been really taken in by it. The combat's really good. Like even in single player, the four turtles play off each other just really well. There's some cool like elemental and mechanical attacks to go with it. Ooh. I haven't gotten a chance to do co-op yet because I don't have any friends on Apple Arcade, because I don't know anyone who uses the Apple Arcade, obviously. But I've been having just a really good time with it on my own. I wish I could get farther in it than I actually do. But when I get into it, I really get into it. And it's just fun, man. Like, it doesn't have, like, the narrative, excuse me, it doesn't have the narrative complexity of Hades, but it does just sort of, like, hit that sweet roguelike spot where when you're in it, you're in it, and you feel like you can just take on the world before you die, and you want to see how far you can go over again. Uh-huh, that's what makes roguelikes fun for me.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I am also a Ninja Turtles fan, so I might need to grab this one also in 2025. Too many games to play the year after next.
I think the best one of the four is probably Raphael, because he's got this rush attack, and he's also got this grappling hook that pulls at least like three enemies in. So if you do that and have elemental attacks that stack on with it, you get like a really good streak going.
Oh, that sounds great. All right, what about this fight? Let me make sure I get this right. Marvel's Spider-Man 2. It's not just like, yes. I don't know, Joe's Spider-Man 2. No, it's Marvel's Spider-Man 2.
It's Marvel's Spider-Man 2 by Marvel. It's like the Mark Jacobs tag for forever ago. Just like designed and written by Marvel. Yeah. So this is Insomniac Games' third Marvel game. And they've just been, Insomniac's output is always like, pretty good, but this one feels like just a really strong sequel. The two Spider-Man setup is really good, and they're pretty great about giving both Peter Parker and Miles Morales like their own segments to play off of. And the combat's really fun with both of their powers. I'm a little more inclined to favor Miles' electrical abilities just because they feel unique. I think Peter's combat just sort of feels like they condensed some of his gadgets from the first game and sort of came up with a narrative reason for like why they're inside of his suit now instead of just regular old gadgets to get rid of the wheel. The larger New York really works. I really enjoy the web wings and sort of the expansive web swinging options. Like I said, the web wings are really cool. And it just, when you fly through these rings scattered around the city, it's fast.
Nice.
And it's just really fast. And it feels really great to sort of switch between that to swinging to the wings again. I think the stealth is generally stronger, and the the real like blockbuster moments hit especially harder. I think this is one of my favorite Spider-Man stories ever.
Oh, nice.
Yes. It's just really, I really enjoy the world that they sort of crafted here. Everyone feels like there's a problem with other versions of Spider-Man where these characters just sort of feel like they're on autopilot or in service of just whatever else is about to happen, sort of like the larger universe. But these characters do not, and I feel like Insomniac has found a very good balance between like these, but like there is a larger world out there in the Marvel universe, but this has to be a Spider-Man story. It cannot be Spider-Man plus the Avengers or Spider-Man plus the X-Men, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and it does.
They've also done a very good job, I think, of making New York feel alive and sort of like getting out of the cop circle that they sort of painted themselves into a corner with the first one. And the cops are sort of like basically non-interactable. There's a firefighter supporting character who you spend more time with through phone calls. And then the spider cop gag from the first one, the first game, is sort of addressed with this returning character from the first game, who basically just like, yo, you kind of, you, that dude kind of sucked. Why did you do that bit?
Nice.
Yeah. It's just, so it's a very like good acknowledgement of like, yeah, the world has changed in the time that we made that game and this one.
Yeah.
And so much of Sony's like first party output is built on making cinematic games, quote unquote, or so like the blockbuster experience. I feel like Insomniac, and even in was it Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart from a few years ago, has managed to find just like a very good balance of this is a big tentpole movie that you could see in theaters, but also this is a gamer. We're going to lean into that really hard.
Yeah,
I don't think it overextends itself. It does just enough of what it needs to and knows to hit its marks like really strongly, and that's why it's one of my favorite games of 2023. And I'm really curious to see what they do with Wolverine and other characters in the Spider-Man universe.
I have not played it. Maybe 2025, but yeah, no, much appreciated. Most of what I know about the game is Aunt May's wheat cakes, because Bryant also wrote about making wheat cakes.
I want to try those wheat cakes.
I do want to try the wheat cakes. Yeah, actually, I do want to try those. That sounds awesome. Sounds like they did some good stuff there. I want to transition us to the Nintendo Witching Hour. Now, here's the Nintendo Witching Hour. It's pretty wild when there's a Mario game and a Zelda game in the same year. That's kind of, you know, has it happened twice? This is something I might ask our fantastic producer Jordan to look up. Was Mario Odyssey the same year as Breath of the Wild? Because if it happened kind of twice in a row, that is. Actually,
I think Odyssey was 2018.
Okay. Yeah, it might have been. They're close, but yeah, if not the same year.
2017.
Oh,
so they were both 2017. Okay. I'm glad I'm not, you know, losing too many brain cells here and finding getting my Marios and my Zeldas mixed up here. But both Super Mario Wonder and Zelda Tears of the Kingdom were on both of our lists, Holly and I. And Holly, I wonder if you want to start with Mario or Zelda. We can talk about both of these. I think they're both pretty awesome, clearly, if they're both on our lists.
We can start with Zelda. I just finished writing my blurb on Mario last night, and I'm like, nice. Can I just read out loud what I wrote? No, I'm kidding. But, but we can start with Tears of the Kingdom.
All right. So for me, Tears of the Kingdom, I was actually a little more down on some elements of it than most people. Most people, it was like praise to the high heavens. And I was like, it does some things better than any game ever. And for me, that's honestly the physics engine and just the things you could do. The player verbs, the like just general player expression was unbelievable. I had some mild complaints. I did not think the dungeon design was kind of anything to write home about. And I wasn't that jazzed with the beginning of the game. It was sort of like, oh, when Breath of the Wild had one of the just best Zelda beginnings and sort of onboarding and the way it teaches you the powers and then opens up was like, oh my God, incredible. And then kind of felt like they fumbled the ball a little on this one. However, I say this and I say it's still like a incredible, beautifully designed game and such an amazing example of what you can do when you're reusing some assets, right? You're reusing a lot of this massive giant world, but you're expanding on it very intelligently. The sort of cloud area, the sky area actually felt really interesting and really cool and really worth exploring. And so did the caves. I spent so much time in those underground caverns. Oh my God, the muddle buds that I had. I had
I'm too afraid to go in those things.
I had hundreds of muddle buds. I had more fun with muddle buds this year than most other video games. Like, it really shows that there were some, like, I've always thought of Breath of the Wild as like teasing some immersive design, you know, some immersive elements, things like the fire and sort of like the way wind and flying kind of works. And this kind of leaned into it a little bit more, which I love as, you know, the MSim chick. That, and honestly, those physics, the way you could make contraptions, the way you could manipulate things in the world, it just felt like playing with physics, which is so much fun and not something I felt often. You know, the Portal games are a good example of kind of playing with physics, and that always feels so good. But this was like doing that, but more creative, which I loved about it. And Holly, I want to let you as well have a chance to sing the praises of Zelda here.
I know we both love Muddle Buds so much.
We're both Muddle Bud friends.
Yeah, it's like from Muddle Buds to Muddle Best Friends. Like,
yeah! There it is. Muddle Besties.
I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Legend of Zelda has never really been a series where you can play it as a stealth game, but when you've got stuff like Muddle Buds, you kind of can, which I appreciate. You know, talk about a game that knows how to reinvent existing assets and get the absolute most out of them. They created a duplicate of the sky and the underground. And then in the case of the underground, it's the same exact map. It is just reversed. And then they did kind of a Super Mario Maker. They said, fine, if you're so clever, you design the game. And then they just gave us all these tools to just, you know, really run with it. Just, yeah. And I can't, you know, from a business perspective, I can't think of a more brilliant way to extend the hours of a game that is built on so many things you already made. Like, that's probably one of the most economical, like, the return on that is probably just tremendous. I know that sounds like a little cynical, but I'm like, no, that's impressive.
A really smart decision, though, because, like, in a couple of weeks, people were just making mess and just destroying everything around them. And I think once you see that, you're sort of like, hey, can I do that? And then also, what can I myself make?
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't think Legend of Zelda would ever be a mischief sandbox game, and yet here we are. And it's got some of the best physics interactions. Like, the complexity is just so well supported. It's a marvel. I mean, you know, what can you say? Here's something you can say. I really just really, I was so disinterested in the story. Those dungeons felt like a chore to me. I was like, I don't think they've cracked how to make the dungeons good in this
like set of games yet.
And it wasn't even just the dungeons. I don't really like the characters, like the, I don't see, I don't know the words of what they were or what they were. Like, the point is,
friends from the sky. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, like, you know, and the little bird one was kind of annoying. And then now these punks are like following me around. And I'm like, okay, you're here. I was having a good time by myself.
They need to be more useful. The fire dungeon with the, I forget his name, but he's sort of like, you shoot him out like a cannon. And sometimes it's just annoying to go through that dungeon with him because he's on like the front of your cart. And everything you do with those characters is locked to one button, which is not great for a game with as many enemies as it has.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the companions from Breath of the Wild a lot more. They're a little bit more dignified, if that makes any sense at all. I don't know. I'm being terrible.
No, not at all. I really had some of the same criticisms here. The parts of the game that felt like the most bespoke, like, we have designed an experience for you, like these characters, like these dungeons, felt like the weakest part when you've made just the greatest physics sandbox ever. And like really fun quest design around a lot of that sandbox stuff. Mm-hmm. The thing with the band at the stables.
I love that one.
Awesome, right? Yeah. Like, so well done. So it's kind of like, just lean in that direction, friends.
I think one thing I like about Tears of the Kingdom is the same thing I kind of like Breath of the Wild, and you mentioning that side quest really brought that up. I really love how it harkens back to Majora's Mask, in my opinion, where there's these really intricate side quests and you know, everyone with their specific schedules and agendas. And then some of the design of the characters as you went along at that. I mean, Majora's Mask is one of my favorite games. So it felt felt really fun to be on an intimate level with these characters again, with their personal concerns and lives and schedules that you just kind of happen to stumble upon. In that sense, I like the series of quests where you're a journalist. How could I not? Yes. Right. I mean, that's,
of course,
that's ours. That's ours. That's for us. Like,
for us.
Nintendo sees us. We're like, this is for you. This is for you, bestie.
This is for you.
That's, yes, I believe that now. Thank you. Yeah. But yeah, it's really nice to feel like you're a part of the lives of the people who actually live in that world. And when you are, when it's a game where you have to have such an intimate knowledge of the land and have such a close relationship with it. I like that. I like that you feel that you're, you know, an observer of people's lives and you get to be included for a moment, but it's very much not about you and they've got their, you know, this whole world without you. And that's, I like that. I like feeling small in such a big world in that sense.
Yeah. Super agreed. Couldn't have said it better. Thank you for that. And how about Mario? How about that little plumber guy with his elephant powers now? I was going to say, I wanted to make like, I like feeling small and it's like you're a little guy running around Mario, but no, he's also an elephant sometimes. So Super Mario Wonder also made my list, just honestly, mostly on how many awesome ideas they just crammed into this game. Mm-hmm. I love platformers. I love just running around, jumping around, just the joy of traversal and interesting obstacle courses and interesting spaces. And they crammed in so many awesome ideas in this game that it's just a joy for me. And Holly, I know it's on your list as well. If you want to talk a little bit about Mr. Mario.
Yeah, I think some things that I touched on, such a departure visually from what they usually do with Mario games. You know, they've really moved away from this kind of traditional primary palette. They've kept some of the iconography and some of the very familiar characters and power-ups and all those sorts of things, but they've very much been reinvented in these levels and environments that are just exploding with a vibrancy that you've never seen in a Mario game before. Like, I think I described it as like playing a Mario game that's set on a Candyland board.
Yeah.
In that sense, where it's very fantasy.
Oh, that's very, very good.
Yeah. It harkens back to a younger age, I think, just in terms of the colors that they chose to use. But I love it. It's so much more vivid than anything you've seen from a Mario game. And I think they kind of knew inherently, if you're going to bring a 2D Mario game back after all the stagnation, that you're going to have to go hard on the new stuff. But how do you sell that? How do you sell it to this audience that is so used to doing the same thing all these years? I mean, for example, you know, all of these Mario things that you can do, wall jumping and stomping, all these things. I've been doing this since Mario 64. How do you keep reinventing this, and how do you reinvent this now after all these years, and how do you make people okay with it? And so I think what they I wrote about this a little bit. I feel like the game, when you play a level, it's like a series of delightful little magic tricks that you keep on stumbling upon and you don't see it coming, you know, and it's going to throw something at you really unexpected, but it's so delightful in practice that you kind of ignore, you know, the novelty of it or how out of left field, like maybe it doesn't seem to make sense thematically in as a whole, but it's so delightful and charming in the moment and so easy to pick up, even if it's very unfamiliar, that you just forget all about that. You know, any resistance you might have towards it being something new in this world, it moves along so quickly and fluidly, and it's so delightful and surprising in the process. You just don't you just keep going. It's just beautiful. The flow of these levels is tremendous. Like, if you like the speed of a Mario level, if you can speed your way through previous Mario games, 2D Mario games, you know, using these controls, you're going to still be able to do that. They've still built for that. It still feels amazing, in my opinion. So you're getting the visual experience still, you're getting that speedy experience still, the audio is incredible. There's one particular early level that has almost like a little mini music video in the middle of it that everyone starts. Yeah. And it's just one of those things.
I think I know the one. It's really good.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, you guys didn't have to do that, but that was so delightful and charming. And you keep using those words because it just is. It's just, it just feels like you're drifting from one little magic trick to another. You know, someone's exploding a bouquet of flowers in your face, and next they're popping out birds from behind their back. You know, it just, and the flow is incredible. And then multiplayer. I don't know if you had a chance to play the multiplayer.
Oh yeah, I've only played it multiplayer. In fact,
oh that's incredible. No, what's that? It's so funny. It's so funny too that you keep on saying Mario this and Mario that. I actually haven't played as Mario. I've only been playing.
Neither have I.
Yep. Yeah. I've been playing as Peach, and I played a little bit as Yoshi. They shouldn't have let me play Yoshi first. I didn't know that Yoshi can't use power-ups and then, also doesn't die. That shouldn't have been my first one.
Oh, no.
Peach is incredible. You know, I wanted that, that high jump drift in the air power from Super Mario's 2, so it was really nice to have that back. It's incredible and interesting how they reinvented the power-up system. And it's different, but I don't resent it for that, which is interesting. Yeah. I'm not good about change, but this game just doesn't make me, I don't resent it at all with this game, which is really interesting. I don't even resent they have to swap out, your different things like your wall jump powers and it kind of sucks, but at the same time, they made it, it's not as much of a drag as you would think that would be. I'm not disappointed in that decision.
We kind of made it work, I think, honestly, with the way everything is designed and kind of adds to the chaos a little bit. So I've only played it multiplayer. I've only played it with my partner who doesn't really play.
I think they've done a good job.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Holly, please.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, but the multiplayer, I do think they did a good job compared to past 2D Mario games. Yeah. It's a little bit easier to actually help one another to get to point A from point A to point B instead of sabotaging each other, which I've played a lot of 2D Mario where the multiplayer is you're stomping on each other and just not being helpful and not paying attention to each other on the screen. Whereas this felt very collaborative and naturally so. Didn't feel like I had to fight too hard for that. And the way the characters' powers kind of fit in together. It's kind of fun when my husband's playing Yoshi and I'm playing Peach and then I accidentally jump on top of him move, bitch, keep going. Get us to the end of the level. Let's move it along. It's
just taking a little ride, Listen, sometimes the princess's feet hurt and, she's got to...
I'm royalty. This is your duty.
This is why I'm called the princess.
It's why we've got dinosaurs to, run
die
around
for
and
your,
jump in the
die
air.
Die for your queen.
Yoshi. Oh, God, Yoshi
deserves to die. He knows what he did.
He knows what he did. What did Yoshi do? Oh no, this is that'll be a different podcast. What Yoshi did
next week?
Tax fraud. That's it. Our producer Jordan has.
You said it, not me.
Has introduced an idea here. Yeah, I definitely I've only played it with my partner who does not play platformers, and it was just a delight. There was a lot of, she was playing as Yoshi, and there was a lot of, why does Yoshi not jump? I think that should be another podcast where I play games with my partner. That might be fun one day, but it was a good time. I adore a multiplayer Mario. It's real fun. It's just a fun time. Oh, all right. We're getting towards the end here. We are getting towards the end. I did want, I wanted to have a shout out round here where folks can shout things out. And I know Holly, Chance of Sinar, also very high on your list. So I'm going to let you get a shout out there if you want to talk about that one a tiny bit. And then everybody can have a shout for anything that that they wanted to just throw out there as hey, this is really great. Really liked it. It was cool.
I just actually picked it up very extremely recently. But I was, drawn to the visual style, which is, becoming more and more popular in games. You look at Sable and I think it was Roller Dome, a very similar French Franco-Belgian comic kind of linear style of art that, the vibrancy of this palette of this game is so brilliant in channeling kind of the glare of the desert. This is a very desert environment. I'm a sucker for language games. This is something that's very inspired by Heaven's Vault. And I say inspired by, but it's like, you know, that language deciphering mechanic is the primary, you know, purpose of this game. Whereas the puzzle aspects have to do with deciphering, you know, this language, and you're learning the story as you learn to break down these symbols. And but it's also about the puzzle aspect of traversing in this, oh gosh, I don't know what the style of building is called, but it's, you know, very traditional style, you know, yeah, the brick old desert buildings. And so, you know, as I was kind of mentioning earlier, it's appeasingly collaborative, even if you have only one person in the driver's seat. I was really enjoying playing with my husband, just figuring out the language aspects together, just piecing it together and kind of, you know, brainstorming out loud and stuff. I really love that part. So yeah, if you get a chance with that, there's actually a demo on Steam, so you can give it a shot before you plunk your cash down. So I would give that a recommend.
Nice. That's awesome. Justin, any shout outs from you? Any games you want to just give them a shout?
Yeah, I will say if you like action games with cool magic systems, to try Forspoken and Immortals of Avium. Ooh. They both kind of came out in not great times and with marketing that either wasn't great or basically non-existent at all. Immortals is basically like, it's got the energy of like a launch title game for the PS4, but it's also weirdly charming. I like how the colored magic system works. I dig some of the combat scenarios they come up with, and the art design of the game is just really cool, especially the magic sigils that basically function as like different guns, like pistols, shotguns, and sniper rifles. Forspoken has a bit of a rough start, but I think it really picks up sort of like once you unlock your second power and you're really allowed to sort of like expand or whatever. That all, it's kind of reminds me of the original Infamous back in 2009 with the way you sort of like get around and how there are challenges for you to like used to get XP to build up your power, which is really cool. Some of the elemental abilities that they come up with are really great. Like you can create like fire minions, or you can do this electrically powered triple jump and sort of like create seeker missiles and do these water orbs that sort of like suspend enemies in midair, and then you sort of blow them up with a different power. It's very great. And then also, I haven't gotten a chance to play a lot of this yet, but I want to shout out El Paso Elsewhere.
Nice.
It's got really great like Max Payne vibes and sort of this awesome cosmic weirdness. And it feels just very satisfying to like jump into the air, do bullet time, blast enemies back, and like sort of repeat that over again, or stake vampires through the heart. So I would check out all three of those.
Oh, that sounds awesome. All those sound really good. Thank you for those. I'm going to do two real quick shout outs of like cool, funky indie puzzle games that I played this year. Cocoon, which just has really, really fun and interesting design and a beautiful abstract sort of visual style. Just really fun and satisfying. Makes you feel smart when you figure out the puzzles. I love that. That's good brain juice for me, you know. And Jusant, which is like a really gorgeous and kind of cute, a platformer, yeah, kind of platformery, puzzly type of game that kind of mimics rock climbing and some of the things that are awesome about rock climbing. And then it kind of goes somewhere from there. It has some really fun visual flair to it. It has some kind of fun puzzle light elements to it. So yeah, those two were my kind of, it's like I want to put these in a little box together of like cool Game Pass games that I played and really loved for a couple of hours that gave me good brain juice. Those are my category there. Recommendation. You know what? Listen, I enjoy these things. They're real good. Awesome. So thank you both so much. Thank you to our producer, Jordan. This has been our part one of our Games of the Year here at Game Developer. And stay tuned for some more awesome games.
Hello and welcome back from your hopefully relaxing break. We are still on the Game Developer Podcast, but our host shift has changed, as well as our guests we've got here today. So rotating out to the other half of the Game Developer staff, I am Alyssa McLoon. I am the publisher of GameDeveloper.com. I hover around here every now and then and talk about Hitman. You might have heard some a preamble about that in the last segment. And I'm joined today by Brian Francis, who is our senior editor, and Chris Kerr, who is our news editor. Brian, Chris, want to say a few words about yourselves?
I'll jump in real quick. Hey, I'm Brian Francis. I'm senior editor at GameDeveloper.com. I'm generally like our nerd who's obsessed with Star Wars, so you may hear some Star Wars chatter in the discussion today. I'm also our resident like hobby mini painter, so I have my eye on the world of tabletop wargaming, but for various reasons, tabletop wargames will not appear in this discussion today, mostly because I've been playing like the same one for several years.
You can always find a way.
I'm Chris Kerr, resident news editor at GameDeveloper.com. I'm also the resident Brit, and as you can see from the mess behind me, the resident soup maestro.
Awesome, awesome. I want to talk about soup, honestly, a little bit, because it's like, it just,
I mean, we can.
For me, I bought some stuff for like some pinto beans for this really good rosemary bean soup. Like, it's fantastic. But I guess video games are...
Soup of the year.
Yeah, soup of the year. Drop everything. Let's go over to soup of the year. Pivot to soup. I was talking to Justin about chewing gum yesterday and video game stuff. So we'll take this offline. This will go into the edit meetings. So I guess, like, what's the big game we're going to start things off with? They took Baldur's Gate a little bit, but there's no reason we can't talk about what we like about it too. Anyone has something they want to start off with here right away?
Yeah. So I guess I'm happy to jump in at Baldur's Gate. You know, Alyssa, I know you're a longtime fan. I'm very much a newcomer to the series. And for me, I guess the big appeal was just that it made D&D super accessible. You know, I've always wanted to play the tabletop version. Baldur's Gate 3 just seemed to really provide a great springboard there, and really underline just how narratively winding D&D campaigns can really be.
Yeah, I think Chris and I were both equally surprised by how much by Baldur's Gate 3 this year, in that like it wasn't really on either of our radars to play once it exited early access. But then, like, kind of the general excitement was too much to ignore. And then when I started playing it, like, everyone I knew was kind of excited about the romance options. I was mildly excited about the romance options, like, as the game went on, but I was most intrigued, and I wrote about this over on Game Developer. I was most intrigued just by how, like, the quest design just kind of had this, like, very, like, the right balance of obscuring what the consequences would be with, and then really, like, a cascading payoff of consequences as you went through the game. And it may, even if you missed, like, huge blocks of game content, it never felt out of place. Like, it felt like a really organic journey, which is bananas. Like, I don't think any other, like, usually, I don't think any other game has achieved that. In the RPG space, usually if you miss content, it feels like you really missed out on something, but this felt like a really organic adventure, and Larian deserves all the credit for kind of cracking, like Chris said, something really organic to the tabletop space.
So I was gonna say, like, I've not really played D&D, the tabletop version, but for me, like you said, Brian, Baldur's Gate really hammered home how failure is success, and in many ways you want to fail certain checks because that unlocks new doors, narratively speaking. So is that kind of the same with the tabletop space or not?
In my experience in tabletop, like, it depends on the... Here's the interesting thing, is it depends on the game master. Once I was doing a tabletop game in the Fate system, where I'd been brought in as, like, a guest NPC for the regular group of players, and me and the DM had scripted out, like, a loose series of events that could kind of happen to reveal my character's identity. And the party kept failing the rolls, and we just didn't know how to get my reveal in the time we had. So it's, Alyssa, I think you spend more time in tabletop campaigns than I do. So I guess you can also speak to how failure translates on the table space.
Yeah, I think, like, and I also want to, like, we can talk about soup, we can talk about tabletop games. And this is, like, the new segment now, I'm into this. But yeah, I think, like, what makes a good game master for me, I love consequence, I love failure. I'm playing a tabletop RPG called Heart, which I'm new to, which is based off of Slay the Spire, I think. Oh gosh, if I'm wrong, I'm gonna be like, I just started it. I got roped into the game, and the pitch our GM sent me, because we played the Curse of Strahd campaign for D&D before, was it's brutal, it's about consequences and living with them. And I'm like, yes, absolutely, you had me like one word into that pitch. And I think Baldur's Gate does, it's interesting, because I also wrote an article about Baldur's Gate before it was cool. It was still pretty cool, but back in the early access period, I played a lot of this game. And talking about how dice rolls failure needs to be part of the conversation, because failing a dice roll isn't a fail state. It's a thing that's going to happen, and it's just kind of a way that you inject a little bit of unpredictability into the game. Like, sure, you want to like save scum and maybe like, oh, I really wanted to pass that charisma check, so I'm just going to like, what if I just reload my save? But one thing I've been doing on my now third playthrough of Baldur's Gate post-release is living with every single roll I get. So if I fail something, that is it. And it's honestly interesting to hear like the voice lines that have been recorded to account for things, the way that changes dialogue, the way that kind of makes you come up with new ways to solve like story beats that might be something every player has to experience, like those kind of key arc pillars, but exposes you to a different side of that. So there's just so much player agency that comes out. Sometimes in a different way than you really intend to, once mm-hmm. you just kind of like let go and let the dice take you. It's wonderful.
See, I've really struggled with that. I've had to kind of unlearn the sense that in video games there are right and wrong outcomes. You know, yeah. I've been safe scumming my way right through the first chapter, and yeah, like I've lost characters. I've had characters die on me. I've just made decisions, you know, in game that were quite flippant, and then all of a sudden a party member's left, and I'm like, what? Like that is not something I ever expected. Like Gale just abandoned ship, like, you know, in the space of 2 hours. I was like, well, they might come in handy in the third chapter of the game, so I should probably go and get them back. So I feel like I need to do another playthrough where, yeah, I just kind of like commit to the dice rolls and let fate take me, I guess.
Gale is handy in the third act because sometimes when you're having a complex problem, the best solution is a fireball.
Yes.
Anyone can throw a fireball if they set their hearts to it. I've got sprint and multi-classing, but that's a different podcast. I killed Lazel in my second playthrough because I'm like, surely like when it says like, oh, stab her, I'm like, it's not like, it's just like a fun, playful, like, hey, back off, stab. I'm like, oh no, she's dead and gone. cool. You can do that, but you can still progress the game making a drastic change like that too. So it's fantastic, but I do want to spend too much time talking about Baldur's Gate, but I know listeners already got a little bit of that earlier on. So I'm going to popcorn over to another game I think we've all played on here that I don't think our earlier crew did. Alan Wake. How y'all feeling mm-hmm. about the spooky writer boy? Any strong feelings there?
I've not finished it yet. I think I'm approaching the climax based on conversations I've had with other people.
I'm still in the first act. I should
put okay, right okay.
Away. So I'm super early.
So I guess talking a bit, you know, super broadly about it then, trying to avoid spoilers, because it's relatively fresh, isn't it? I feel like it does a really good job of pivoting to survival horror. I've seen people make comparisons to Resident Evil and Silent Hill as well, some extent. Like, I'm not super familiar with Silent Hill, but obviously the whole sense of split between worlds, you know, there are some puzzle mechanics with the lamp where you can kind of like remove lights and then the world itself shifts. So I think it's super smart in that sense, really smartly designed. The jump scares, I don't know, I always find people's mileage differs with jump scares. Some people think they're a bit overdone. I really enjoy them. I think they're really well implemented in Alan Wake 2. You know, you're walking down a corridor, it's super tense, and then suddenly face on the screen. You know, yeah, I've been playing that game at like 2 a.m., pitch black darkness, like a single candle lit on my windowsill. And then this giant face appears. Pretty terrifying. I've had to remember to turn the volume down at times because my neighbors probably wonder what's going on. but yeah, I think for me personally, it's everything I wanted from that sequel. I feel like the first game really excelled when it lent into the horror sensibilities, and Alan Wake 2 just really carries that thread and runs with it.
I'm going to issue the disclaimer, which is that I did not play Alan Wake 2, but I watched my fiance play so much of it. So by that reason alone, it can't land as a top 10 game of the year for me, because I truly want to honor like playing the games as opposed to just watching them. But Alan Wake 2 is really special, and I don't think you can avoid talking about it if you know what's in it. I need to keep spoilers light for you too, because I know what's going on in the back half of the game. I think my contribution to this game is if you watched the Game Awards and the musical performance by Poets of the Fall, and then this incredible, you know, group of dancers that included all the actors, most of the live action actors from Alan Wake 2,
including Sam Lake, which is it's always baffling to me. Like, game director, yeah. Sam Lake, yeah.
Game director and now dancer. Without spoiling how that song appears in the game, I think what truly blew my mind about the space that it exists in is that Remedy has been experimenting with filming live action video and inserting it into their games for a hot minute. Quantic Dream mm-hmm. No, not Quantic Dream. Quantic Dream's the game studio. And Quantum Leap's the TV show. Well, this is embarrassing. I can't remember the name of their...
Quantum Leap's also the game. Quantum Break.
Quantum Break.
Quantum Break. Yeah. Yeah, it is not the Scott Hamula show where he jumps bodies. In that game, Remedy began experimenting, you know, with including live action video with their gameplay, you know, like streaming in that content from the Xbox Cloud system. And then in Control, you know, you had this live action footage mapped onto the real gameplay of, you know, the director kind of in a smoky room. Then you also had like the video content with the creepy puppets and with Dr. Darling. Just good stuff, but it didn't quite click with me. And then there's a level back in the back end of Alan Wake 2 that feels like they took that, they've been honing this technology for like a decade, and it's paid off in such a way that like completely changed my opinion about it. And it feels like a new frontier in video games and horror games and metatextual games. Like, this game is truly a mixed media game. Yeah. And for that reason, I'm just blown away by it, even though I didn't play it. It's something special, and the sincerity of Sam Lake and the rest of that team shines through in the game, shines through in how they talk about it. We've run some great stories, great interviews with the team this year. I suggest you all go to gamedeveloper.com, just search Alan Wake 2, and just find all of our wonderful interviews by a lot of different writers about the game, and just celebrate it, cheer it. This is something special. This is something special for the video game industry, and I hope the conditions that brought it to life, you know, get to spread out to other studios.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like it's a miracle that Alan Wake 2 exists in its current form. You know, the troubles Remedy had are well documented in terms of trying to get the sequel off the ground. I think American Nightmare came out, what, 2013 or something like that. I mean, I could be way off base here.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a pseudo sequel. You know, and then I think they tried to kickstart a dedicated sequel maybe like 6-7 years ago, and then that just kind of fell through for whatever reason. And then this comes out.
Not literally kickstart, by the
no,
way.
No, yeah. You know, and then this finally comes out, and it is such a meta experience on every conceivable level, from a big budget studio, the amount of polish, you know, just like even little things like the lighting, absurd in terms of how well it's been imprinted. Yeah.
Yeah, it's astounding. Sorry, you just reminded me. So we have this like obnoxious gamer light setup in our like basement with the TV where like all our game consoles live and the basement where they belong. But it's like one of those like cameras that looks at the thing for like lights on the back of it. It was my mental health purchase like in the pandemic years. With Alan Wake, it makes you appreciate the like art design so much more, because the sharp kind of contrast between colors, like when you switch certain elements about levels to make it from one narrative to another narrative. So a lot of like whites and like these really bright lights or these really grimy green lights, and then these red comes out, and like having that around the TV really makes you appreciate that more. And like the jump scares coming up too, there's so much like visual design and kind of distinction there that just creates this ambiance and this atmosphere where kind of like how you were playing it, Bryant, where you were watching your partner play it. It's this cinematic experience almost, like you're part of the narrative, you're part of the story. And that's always been like, Alan Wake kind of lives in that, like, it's a very weird story on its own. It's about a writer who's writing this like wild novel that I've sat there and like, I used to read the YouTube or listen to a YouTube video of someone reading the pages from the first game off, like when I was like starting college. There's such a weird narrative there too, but it's like it's a collaborative experience. It's very film like, kind of like what you were saying before. But I think Alan Wake does one thing really interesting. It does several things really interesting. But it's a sequel that's like very different from the original game. I hated the combat in the first game. The like flashlight to take the shield down and shooting someone while there's like being swarmed felt a lot more like claustrophobic and constrained. And given I'm like 4 hours in to the game right now, so maybe it will get. But it just seems like more experiential than kind of like a linear go here, solve puzzle, shoot bad guy, go here. Like it's the atmosphere is so much more powerful and almost like impressive or oppressive in a very immersive and I guess impressive way.
Before we move on from Alan Wake 2, and there's so many other great games to talk about besides Alan Wake 2, I think like I'd urge listeners, I'm used to calling everyone readers. I'd urge listeners and readers to pay close attention to how the game is inspired by a lot of other media. A lot of developers will cite other games being huge inspirations for them, and you can kind of see like super close lifts of that style in their games, especially the TV show Twin Peaks. This is a game that wears its Twin Peaks inspiration on its sleeve, but because I've happened to be starting a first-time watch of Twin Peaks while watching this, it's very clear how Remedy and the team have taken inspiration from it, but like have not become derivative. And there's a lot of like filmic references. You obviously, you know, you have these, there's stuff in the video set pieces that I think people should pay close attention to, the noir sensibilities of the world Alan Wake himself is trapped in. I've been harping on this game's like artistic merits, and you know, this is a game that steals like a pro. It is clear about what is referencing, but it is still wholly unique and wholly fused with its own personality. So go take a close look at all that.
Cool. All right. I again could talk about this forever, but I will cut off and move on so we can talk about some other games that might have slipped off people's radar. I'm going to dip more into kind of your personal shouts, your personal list, and I'll put you on the hot seat here. So, Chris, is there a game from your list that you just really want to shout out right now and really want to kind of talk through why it mattered so much for you this year?
Yeah, so there's two actually. The first one is Humanity, the very strange, surreal, Lemmings-esque puzzler from Enhanced, the Japanese studio, and Va Limited, which is a Japanese design company that worked with Enhanced on this. They've done like a lot of marketing campaigns for brands like Uniqlo. So yeah, a little bit of a weird tangent for them to dive into the games industry. But Humanity it's almost impossible to describe, which leaves me in a very tough situation here. when I was writing the blurb for this, my intro line was, "What if dog but God?" And that's kind of the hook behind Humanity. You are this glowing, omniscient Shiba that's basically tasked with, you know, guiding hordes and hordes of celestial beings from one end of a level to the other so that they can ascend to some never world. It's never really fully described what this world is. And yeah, it starts out very simple. You're just barking commands left, right, you know, up, down, jump into this pool, swim upwards, and then, you know, hopefully go to what you think is heaven. But, you know, it could be something else, more sinister. And then, yeah, it just lets loose later on. You know, people get weapons, clubs, lightsaber-style sticks, guns.
It's like very, yeah, like, 0 to 60.
Yeah, it really is. It escalates quickly, let's say. And you just feel at times like a parent. You're trying to guide humanity from its humble origins, you know, to better pastures. And I did that with differing levels of success. Often had to sacrifice a few souls along the way. But in terms of the actual puzzle design itself, it's just really smart. It makes you feel smart. And I think that's a really good indicator of solid puzzle design. I remember once I was playing it, a friend was staying at mine, and we'd been out the night before, and we were just kind of hanging out in the morning on the couch, passing the controller across to each of us, just trying to get through these puzzles. And sometimes we get stuck for like 20 minutes. But then when it clicks, you just feel like an idiot. You feel like, how did we not see that before? I think that's so smart. You know, we never really got tired of the puzzles. We never thought, oh, let's just turn this off and try something else. You know, the solution always feels like it's just beyond the veil.
I think you described this in Slack as being a little bit like Baba Is You, like kind of puzzle, or someone did.
It's like you need to kind of reframe your perspective. And you
it's
know
humbling
you've got
and also like satisfying.
It is. Because, you know, at the start of the game, you're given all the tools. And then later on, it's like, right, here's this convoluted level. And you only have one command you can issue. And you can only issue that command, say, 3 times. So you know the solution's there. You know, it's very overt about that.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, on a technical level as well, I interviewed the devs earlier this year. And I think they said that it's made in Unity, and they said that they actually broke what might have been the record for like the number of on-screen NPCs in the game. So most levels can accommodate, I think it was around 5,000 NPCs at once. And then there's one level towards the finale, and I was told that that's maybe up to 10,000, which apparently the engineers at Unity were flabbergasted by. So I mean, that is pretty impressive, you know, 10,000 NPCs in one puzzle.
I remember we have one of our more popular articles from ages ago is like about like networking issues in like the early 2000s for having 12,000 or 1200 units on screen at once for an online game, and now like how far we've come.
And I guess also Humanity, obviously building off of the legacy of Tetris Effects, Lumines, games like that, It also has like a pretty interesting soundtrack that, you know, I did write out some notes and tried to define it. And I was like, the best thing I can say about it is that it's kind of like a yoga retreat in the Vatican hosted by robots, like very choral, religious, but almost, I don't know. It's odd. You have to listen to it. And again, there's a cadence to the gameplay, you know, it's in pursuit of this synesthesia that I think Tetris Effect tried to achieve as well. And it really does achieve that. It's weird.
Yeah. No, I feel like the more you describe this game, the less I know what it is too. Like, I'm like, I have an idea. And like, no, it's a concept. I'm not even sure it's a game. Can you play it or can you experience it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm talking about it and I'm at this point, just feel like I'm just saying words. But hopefully there's some logic behind them. If people listening want to go and play it, I would definitely recommend it. I hope it makes a lot of end of year lists. I don't know if it will, because I feel like it's been an incredibly stacked year. It's definitely deserving of some time. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then the other one was Jassant as well. Just to end up that quickly, little climbing game from Don't Nod. You know, doesn't outstay its welcome, about 4 hours long, builds on the mechanics seen in Tears of the Kingdom. A bit more depth to it, so you might have to, like, you know, knock pittons into walls and
this is the climbing game that's kind of like a little quappy, but or QWP.
I mean, on a basic level, it's pretty straightforward. It's basically the climbing mechanic from Tears and Breath of the Wild combined with the sensibilities of Journey. You know, the path is linear, you're going up, that's it. You know, in Journey, you're walking towards a mountain. In Jassant, you're trying to reach the summit, but you've got like a
new fall.
You can, but I mean, I didn't die. Okay. Not for like a trying
like
at times.
Chill kind of energy. I'm trying to like, interrogate
sounds,
you about.
Sounds
it.
Like a skill
now.
Issue.
Yeah.
If you fall.
Yeah.
I think it's more. You know, like even there are moments where there are kind of leaps of faith, but you know, if you've done everything right, you can only dangle precariously. I don't think you can actually die. But again, I did my best to avoid that, so I can't confirm. Just a really cute, wholesome experience that is impactful, does what it says on the tin, doesn't say it's welcome. You know, I've been drawn to shorter games this year. So for me, that's definitely up there.
Very good. I guess, Brian, any, you want to talk through, we don't have to do like a popcorn thing. We do a longer discussion, whatever works for us here. We got time.
Yeah. Oh man. I looked at my list and I was like, I could go on for all of these games for so long. So I'm going to rapid fire through two of them. The Dead Space remake is the first one I'll celebrate. I did not play the original Dead Space. So this was my first time with the whole series. So it's interesting to talk about as a game of the year because, a lot of design decisions at the heart of it were made, you know, over a decade ago and before 2010, several console generations ago by a wholly different team. But Motive did such a good job, like punching up those up and making them for the modern era. By the end of the game, I was like, not just so impressed by, you know, like the ability to rip creatures apart, like explore the ship, like get all these blood and guts everywhere. I was also impressed. I considered the world it was in, like, and the game experience, like, fleshed out this whole sci-fi world that felt really organic and lived in, and it felt like a really good sci-fi novel. I'm only speeding past it because, like I said, it's a remake and it's a little hard to talk about and like, oh, what was made this year, what was made back then. And I'll come to on my train tour of my favorite games of the year, I'll stop at the station of RoboCop Rogue City, which I did not expect to like as much as I did. I kind of grabbed it on a lark. And I wanted to write about it, but it's been such a hectic time at the end of the year. The gunplay is like pretty fun, like kind of like in an age where I feel like shooters are speeding up. This one slows down to make it feel like RoboCop's a tank kind of walking into a sea of goons. It's pretty cool. Like it's not I'd still put Doom remake and other shooters, Wolfenstein, the new Wolfenstein games like well ahead of it, but what I finally realized, like, made it click for me is that there's a moral binary in this game that is similar to other, you know, like, dialogue trees in terms of, like, you know, we're used to, like, using the system for good or evil. Mm-hmm. But RoboCop makes the most out of a limited system by asking the player to make choices between what is, I can quickly describe as lawful good and neutral good, or more like lawful neutral and neutral good. To use the D&D alignment chart. The way I would poetically describe it is RoboCop is asked to frequently decide between empathy for the downtrodden people of Detroit and upholding a legal system that has done the downtrodden. It's what makes old Detroit so downtrodden. And players are sort of given free grace to do either of them. And there are fun little consequences that play out for either of them. But kind of like it's very in the moment. It's not about, unlike Baldur's Gate, where like the consequences can be so delightful. Like the consequences kind of don't, I don't know, they aren't the most important thing I've ever felt in the game. But there's just something special about being RoboCop, still voiced by Peter Weller, who is confronted with someone, you know, who's broken the law and says, like, please, I really, like, I need help right now. I didn't do it. And RoboCop can just say, I will let you off with a warning. And being able to make that choice to sort of be torn between, you know, your prime directives and serving the public trust. It's neat. I really dug that.
So I'm going to like duck from some tomatoes. As I say, like I'm saying this as someone who's never seen RoboCop and I really, really need to. I've been scolded for that before several times, but
brief podium, anyone who scolds anyone for not having seen a movie, sorry, don't do that. Just encourage
people. It's like loving movies. Scolding. Like why not? You would like be all about this or like you'd really get something out of this. So I've got a few on that list. But I think with kind of the complex messages going on in like the original movie as well, adding like some bringing it over to like a game medium and giving you that ability to make these choices in the moment is kind of like this really cool reflection of, we see all these like conversations about IP coming over to video games versus like, or video games going over into other like cross media. Like it's getting more talked about anyway, and it's really cool to see adaptations kind of play to the strengths of each medium instead of just adapting, you know. So like I, as someone who's never played the RoboCop game or watched the movie, I think that's really great.
Yeah, I think a worse version of this game would have just like endlessly quoted some of the original things. They would have like leaned hard into fan service. Like you would have heard like, I'd buy that for a dollar, like super early.
I was going to say Dead or Alive, you're coming with me, but that's Judge Dredd, isn't it? Or is that RoboCop?
No. That's RoboCop, Yeah. Yeah, I think he says it at some point, but I didn't clock it. And I've just met some really people with really bad RoboCop opinions over the years who are like, they say things like, you can't, like RoboCop doesn't seem as funny today because the real world caught up with all the satire. And I'm like, no, that's you just kind of being a jerk. And I will scold people for having bad opinions, I guess, and not having seen certain movies. But I think there's something special about what the developers did with this game in terms of like you said Alyssa they got their hands on a movie license. They had the opportunity to just kind of make something mid, and instead they swung for the fences in gameplay, swung for the fences in this moral choice system, and kind of let that be where they sharpen their knives, and sort of at the expense, you can tell it's at the expense of other systems, but like they made something worth playing, and that's like a thumbs up for me.
What kind of cop were you, Brian?
Empathetic. I went in being like, I'm going to be like pure RoboCop.
Just like hardline, just throwing people out of windows. Yeah. Like,
And then the second I like someone gave me a sob story, I was like, I will let you off with a warning. And that was it. Downhill from there. Do I have time, Alyssa, to gush about like truly one of my favorite games this year?
Let me just talk real quick about my two games that I guarantee neither of you have played, and nobody may be listening to this, or maybe one of them. I'll just do like a really quick thing, and then I'll let y'all take it there. I just want to shout out, I'm just going to do this one quickly. Storyteller is a fantastic little game. I don't think it came out this year, but it did come out on iOS this year, I believe. But it's all about taking a tiny little mechanic of you have kind of a storyboard and you're slotting characters into different scenes. And then this creates kind of a domino effect where previous scenes unlock, make the scene behave differently. And you have to like solve a state of like, this guy kills the king, marries the queen, and then the queen kills him back. And it's a really fun, simple little game that takes a mechanic that is very like, I don't know, the thesis statement is one sentence and builds on it in this really cool way. I wish it were longer, but it's also the perfect size at the same time. I want to shout just real quick, Rhapsody of Musical Adventure, the second and the third game, and that came out from a NIS America's collection this year. And just like, this is a weird, like, I feel like I'm dreaming a little bit when it exists, because this was a musical RPG that's very similar to Disgaea. It was kind of one of the formative games, I think, right before the Disgaea series got started, if I'm remembering back way too far. And it was starring a girl, which when you're like a tiny little thing renting PS1 games from the local rental store and you find this like musical game, it's fantastic. It had a soundtrack disc in the PlayStation thing, the first one, it was fantastic. And you're rescuing the prince, and still being like a big old like head over here, falling in love with him. There's some problematic body image, lines in the songs, but like, hey, it was the 90s. The second and third game in that series, the Marvel's Kingdom series, never were localized over the United States. There's some unofficial translations floating around online. This is a game that came out like in the 90s. And just out of nowhere, last year they announced the Rhapsody remake for certain re-release for Switch, which was fantastic. And then they brought over the second and the third game, which were never released over here. And I think that is so dang cool. And I just want to like shout about how wonderful it is to see games that weren't given a chance in certain markets get a second shot. I haven't played a ton of them. There's some like interesting changes there. I could probably do another, we could do a whole podcast about just like this kind of stuff. But I just wanted to like be like, hey, thanks for having that exist and more people should play it. It's a really, really interesting kind of look at that era of turn-based games and kind of like the grid-based strategy game, but in like a lot softer lens because it was for a younger audience. So it's a really cool game. And then Mile a Minute, just I have to say Hitman. I just want to like really quick mention.
Excuse me.
I listened to the first half of the episode before we recorded, and they're like, oh, someone's going to bring up Hitman. Wonder who it could be. And I'm like, I'm doing it. You know what? They made this happen. The team at IO Interactive, I sing their praises every time. I think what they did with the Hitman trilogy was fantastic. I think the stuff they did in previous years, adapting Hitman to a VR game and adding new mechanics to make this work while still being the same game, incredible work. Just like it's a masterclass in, I don't know, bringing that kind of sandbox feeling into the development process as well, instead of just being on the front end of it. It's really cool. But what they did with Hitman World of Assassination is kind of, oh my gosh, they took the three games they released and they made it into a live game platform essentially and added more replayability. So they took these very three linear games that were a certain structure and adapted it to kind of how people are playing games more now and made this endlessly playable game even more endlessly playable with more rewards and like a different kind of progression path. And I think that's really cool. We have about like 2-ish minutes left and I'm going to like throw it back to Brian so you can say the thing you wanted to say. I just had to shout out those three.
I mean, talking of like teasing and setting things up, I did mention I have to talk about Star Wars on this call as this president Star Wars turned. And we got one of the best Star Wars games of all time with Star Wars Jedi Survivor. I love a good Star Wars story, and Respawn told another one. Like the idea of like traumatized survivors making their way and trying to find a safe haven as fascism falls on the galaxy, like is told really well, even though I am very fortunate to not live in a world where authoritarianism and fascism have forced me to make such similar choices. But the energy oozing off the story and how it affects the characters like stands out as much as these like great set pieces. You know, like there's a minute where you're fighting a Trident class assault ship that is just it blows my mind. Like this big squid ship that I was like holy crap. Like I just lost my mind doing that one. It's special to me. It's Star Wars is sometimes like a hard thing to feel like a fan of because of all the hot takes, like the fact that it's a hyper commercialized thing. But like between this and Andor and The Last Jedi and other good stories in the universe, like it reminds me why I fell in love with this and why I like am still here in the freezing cold waiting for something as good as, you know, those stories to always like come back and give me warmth.
Do you feel like Respawn are on track to make potentially the best trilogy in the Disney era, Brian? Or
I'm not going to make any predictions like that anymore. Like, I'm just that's a losing game. I think what I also act
right for the structure for the yeah.
I think I'll take a sec to quickly like add in that this isn't just about a Star Wars story. Like, the combat was introduced in Jedi Fallen Order, and it's been punched up and polished here to be, and with some great accessibility options that make, you know, kind of a Dark Souls inspired combat and progression system like a lot more user friendly. And I think like, but Respawn from Titanfall through now has just had level designers who are just always trying something new, always at the sharp of their game. The fight with the squid ship that I mentioned before. Is one such example, but there's also just like side areas you'll wander into and you're like, oh, I'll just pop in here and find a little audio recording. Like it's going to be net. And then 10 minutes later, you're like, the bridges have been collapsing on me. Like I tried to traverse here, but then it forwarded me to another space. And by the time you've like gone through this winding little puzzle of like a space that's kind of folded in on itself in terms of like how much room you think is in there versus how much room there actually is, you're just sitting here and going like, someone made this, like someone like made this and iterated on it. And like with all good games, when you can feel kind of like some developer whose name you don't know, kind of like reaching their fingers in the space and helping you have a good time. Like, that game's got it. And I'm a little surprised it fell off the Game of the Year conversations this year. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. So many good things came out this year.
So early year game too. And those are always like, I feel we need like a mid-year game awards, honestly. Like, oh my gosh. Lower, not proper noun game awards, just like awards that are given to games. I pushed a meeting back, so we have 5 more minutes. Chris, is there one more game you want to shout out on? Because I think Brian might use it right now.
I'm going to go on back for Dredge. Again, came out at the top of the year. I feel like it, to be fair, this is a game that has had a lot of praise throughout the year. It seems to have stayed in the spotlight, which again underlines just how impressive it is when you're managing to maintain your place in the spotlight in a year this stacked. And yeah, I just think it's a really tight experience, masterful design in terms of building tension. You know, I've been to a few talks by the developers, Black Salt Games, and they say, you know, it's a cozy horror game, which is a weird combination. But it's horrifying that actually sometimes it's the unseen. That's really what you're most afraid of. You know, there are only really 4 main monsters in the game to defeat, 4 key areas. But often it's just those moments where you're stranded at sea and you realize that because you didn't really plot out a journey as effectively as you thought you did, because in the game, the passage of time is tied to your movement. Mm-hmm. So the clock only ticks when you're sailing. And then all of a sudden the night draws in and you're like, oh, I don't really have the fog lights for this. And the ocean's getting pretty crazy. I just think that game, fantastic. And again, another game where it's probably about 10 hours, you know, again, doesn't outstay its welcome. Mm-hmm. You can sit down a few Sundays in a row and breeze through it. And it's just nice to see a small team do well. It was Black Salt's debut game. It sold 1 million copies. It's given them financial security to go on and make something else. I know they're making DLC for Dredge, but you know, it seems like they'll go on to maybe do a sequel. You'd imagine the sequel will be on the cards at some point. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just think a studio...
David Diver 2 collab, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And I just feel like a small studio being able to secure its future after one project is, you know, that's a huge win in 2023, isn't it? That's worth celebrating.
The whole like time moves when you move thing is like something we usually think about with Superhot, you know, that excellent shooter. And hearing it here, like that's a really effective use for it, because observing it in action, once again, kind of by watching other people play. Just the effect, okay, I've stopped moving and there's an ominous shape in the water below me, and you're just kind of sitting there staring at it and it's staring at you. And like, that's pretty Eldritch right there. That's pretty like, you can't see the chef's kiss I did, listeners, but that's pretty good stuff. Good soup.
When I'm not very far into Dredge, because this is my holiday break. I'm going to play video games finally. Looking forward to it. But I'm like, oh, this like time only moves when you move. I'm like, what a comfortable mechanic. That makes me feel so much better about it being scary and like all of this. And then like you get a little bit further, you're like, oh no, this is actually enhancing the thread so much. I feel like there's a certain urgency in horror games when I'm just like, screw it, I'm being chased by some shadow dude and I'm just gonna bolt through this hallway at Alan Wake. And like that urgency really kind of takes the decision making paralysis and like that level of like inherent fear in the back of my mind out. And Dredge is like, no, here you go. You need to really think about this. You did this to yourself. Enjoy. I want to talk forever, but I think that's going to take us to time here. So I'm hopeful we might be doing some more of these little team chats throughout the year, and then maybe then we'll be able to talk about even more games that came out and not have to just kind of focus on just our goatee. I'd love to do like monthly check-ins like this, but we'll see how it all goes. Mm-hmm. So thank you for listening to the Game Developer Podcast. It has been wonderful to talk at you today. If everything goes to plan, you should be able to enjoy a brand new gamedeveloper.com web experience during, before, or after listening to this podcast episode. We've put a lot of work into it, so please enjoy. We've got a fresh new coat of paint on the website. A lot easier to navigate around content, a lot easier to find things. And we've got some exciting plans for 2024 to kind of leverage those cool new features into just digging into the archives of game developer content and resurfacing some really great hidden gems. So keep an eye on that. Subscribe to our podcast, like, review, all of that stuff. Subscribe to a newsletter if you're a newsletter guy. We're around. But yeah, it's been wonderful to have you. And thanks so much.